Hi everyone, my name is Eugenia Chow and I run the Instagram account Ugreenia. The Everyday Activist podcast is founded under the belief that there's no one-size-fits-all approach to activism and anyone can get involved. Timothy Tan, also known as Eco Timmy on Instagram, is an environman and earth advocate based in Singapore. Through running his platform and spearheading other sustainable initiatives in his community, he hopes to debunk the myths that climate change is a problem for women to solve and that men should care less about the environment. In this episode, we discuss toxic masculinity as a barrier to sustainability, what it's like thrifting as a man, coping with eco-anxiety, and interfaith environmentalism. I've been so inspired by Tim's efforts to go against the norms to fight for a planet we deserve, and I'm sure you will be too. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Tim, and welcome to this episode of the Everyday Activist podcast. It's so good to have you on here.
Hi, Gina. Thank you so much. It's really exciting and I can't wait to hear what you have to ask and to say.
Yes. So firstly, could you tell us a bit about your background? What inspired you to get involved with sustainability? And more specifically, what made you decide to advocate for male climate action?
I think I have quite the typical environmentalist backstory, you know. I've always loved watching documentaries when I was younger. Like David Attenborough was like, you know, my dream guy. I was always all inspired by like these documentaries, these wildlife documentaries. And I realized I couldn't love animals without saving them, you know. And these documentaries never really had an environmental, like a conservation factor to it. Maybe at the end of the video, you know. But after I realized I need to watch more like conservation and more research or more climate change documentaries. So I started watching those and I got really, really interested in them. And after that, I just got fully immersed into it. So yeah, and I decided very early on that, maybe I'll dedicate my entire life to this because, you know, I can't just let it go, you know, like this is a really big thing to me and I needed to like, you know, really immerse myself into it. Regarding the male climate action, I volunteered for one of like an EcoFest and out of like the 60 volunteers there, I realized that I was the only guy. So that was like, this is really strange, you know, and there's a really big problem here, but I didn't know what it was, you know. I was wondering where were all the guys? And so I started doing some research on like male involvement in, you know, whether it's being vegan, whether it's being zero waste. I started really looking into it. And I found out that it's true that there's a whole entire missing segment to the environmental sector, you know, and that guys weren't putting in effort or weren't doing green stuff just because they didn't see it as masculine. And that's such an absurd idea to me that like your genitals should dictate whether you save the planet or not, you know? You know, so and realize that this is a really big issue in terms of your self-worth, in terms of your identity as a man and your future. So I realized that it makes no sense for somebody to not want to save your planet because of your gender and because of your identity, you know? So, and there's so many areas of masculinity that intersect with the environment, like political, social, economic. And this is like a really big area that was untouched. So I decided to really try to advocate and try to normalize the idea that, a man actually can save the planet and it's not effeminate, it's not emasculating to do so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was also doing some reading on why males don't necessarily participate in green behaviors. So there's two terms. One is associative and one is dissociative. So one of them is the fear of being too feminine or the fear of not being masculine enough.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Wow. I didn't know that. Thank you so much for educating me on that. Okay. Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. I think it's about appearing too feminine. Because the whole reason why, I mean, to my research and to like just my own personal experience, the whole reason why a lot of guys don't talk about these things is because we have been brought up in such a situation that, like, hey, you're supposed to have an apathetic relationship with your surroundings. Mm-hmm. And if not apathetic, if not ignorant, it would be aggressive. You know, so like we are brought up in this environment, and right, caring for the planet requires you to have an emotional connection with nature. And having that emotional connection is like a big no-no to like the testosterone gods, right? So I think people, I think a lot of guys still feel that it's emasculating. It's not feminine. It's not too feminine.
Mm-hmm.
It's emasculating. You know, it reduces their sense of worth because you have to be vulnerable. And no guy can be vulnerable, right? I don't know, according to what society teaches us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the reason why.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So how have people, I guess guys in particular, or people that identify as more masculine, responded to your work and initiatives when it comes to bringing a male perspective on this toxic masculinity?
Terribly. Okay, not to discredit my work. Okay, not to discredit my work. But in the army, there's like a lot of like unspoken rules that have already been set in stone, you know, and then this random guy just comes in and says, screw them rules, let's talk about our feelings towards the planet, right? Like, obviously, they'll be like, what the F is this guy doing? So, I can understand where they're coming from. You know, it's a really uncomfortable process unpacking why we behave this way and why we are brought up this way. And it's the same reason why people find it hard to go for like therapy, you know, because you're confronted with certain traits you didn't even know that, you know, you didn't even know were there. So it was really difficult trying to talk to them about things like toxic masculinity when you are submerged in testosterone, you know. And it was really uncomfortable at first, but you know, I sort of like worked my way through it. I kind of understood how to talk to them about it and really bring up the subject without making them feel threatened at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a really, really had to really calculate and have a nuanced view on how to dictate such a path to talk to them about these things, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was really interesting how you described, in one of your posts, you described national service as a carnival of toxic masculinity. I can imagine how that could be. What was this experience like for you? And what is your typical approach for speaking to someone who refuses to acknowledge the role of their like toxic masculinity in exacerbating these problems?
Mm-hmm. Yep, so okay, first of all, to like, if any of my army friends are listening to this, like, it makes me like hate them. I do not hate them. I love them very much. But it was really difficult as start of army because, they were literally having shirtless brawls in the bunk, and it was really, really, it was a different atmosphere altogether, you know. And there was a lot of like casual sexism, casual homophobia, casual racism, a lot of like pseudo ego. And I realized that maybe this wasn't the best place to talk about toxic masculinity and the environment. Maybe it wasn't right for me to just, you know, like blurt it out in front of a conversation and say like, oh, guys, let's talk about the planet. Let's talk about, you know, why you should not, you know, do these and et cetera. But, you know, then I realized that, like I said just now, I needed to take a more nuanced and careful approach in talking about these things. And I took it to myself to really find like the best way to talk about these issues. So like I made like mental notes as to what I should do and what I shouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out of this final 3 points, you know. My first method was to respond to them. So like to wait for them to bring up the subject, you know. So if they were talking about, maybe they were talking about why feminists are fighting for more rights than men. Well, women are fighting for more rights than men. And I have to subtly correct them by responding to them. You know, I wouldn't bring up the subject of feminism. I would try to correct them in their terms of view, trying to understand why they believe such things, try to bust their misconceptions on certain things, you know. So, but I kind of realized that it wasn't enough, like just waiting for them to say something and responding to them. I wasn't actively fighting. I didn't feel like an ally. I didn't feel like an environmentalist by waiting for them to say things and then correcting them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even if I did, they had really like harsh responses to it. So it wasn't a very effective method, just waiting to respond to them.
Mm-hmm.
And like my second method was to make them talk about it by doing it myself. So it was 2 months into army when I realized that, okay, maybe I should start eating vegetarian food, because at the start I wasn't eating vegetarian food. My rations were still had meat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to change my rations to vegetarian food. And then everybody was like freaking out. They're like, why are you doing this? You know, it's disgusting. You know, and I guess they felt threatened by it, you know, that I was some sort of on like some sort of moral high horse, and they were and they just didn't feel comfortable with it, you know. So I took this as a chance to try and bring up the subject of, okay, like, you know, why the benefits of eating vegetarian, having a vegetarian diet, a vegan diet, the environmental impact of eating meat, etc., etc. So, and this wasn't the most effective way, mm-hmm. because we had like arguments, or not arguments, but like debates every single day, you know, on this situation. And as much as I tried my best, I think every environmentalist, and I'm pretty sure you will know that statistics don't change opinion. So it was really hard to try to sway them, you know, to actually just have them have a proper conversation, a mature conversation about like a vegan diet or vegetarian diet.
Mm-hmm.
And let me give you an example. So one time, I was eating my food, and my friend was saying, you know, actually, this is really bad for the environment, because if 100% of the world became vegan, then the world will have to provide so much more crops, and it'll take so much more land. It'll be so much more, like, that takes so much warm water. And then I argue back with him, saying, you know, livestock takes about like 90% of like deforestation in the Amazon rainforest. Uh-huh. And no matter how many statistics I pulled out my ass, like, he would, you know, then in the end, when he realized he lost the argument, he'll say things like, oh, but actually, we need to kill more cows because they're producing so much methane. So by killing them, by eating them, you know. And then the entire weight and the gravity of the conversation kind of falls through. Mm-hmm. And then it just leaves me there like,
Yeah. Just like,
I'm pretty sure you would relate to it, right? Yeah, do you have any experiences with this?
Yeah, I feel like with certain people, or like guys, to convince them to go vegan, you have to show them images of like vegan bodybuilders who are like
exactly massive. Right.
But then by doing that, you're still catering it to the whole image of like what it means to be masculine.
Yeah
And so it's like, do you want to do it through that method? Because you're just perpetuating
it's really a vicious cycle, right?
Yeah, it's definitely difficult.
And so like my third and last method was, which I found was the most effective, was talking about bigger systemic issues, like away from personal and individual action.
Mm-hmm.
So when I start talking about things like climate change, like political stuff and climate policies, and like I was just ranting to them about Singapore's ineffective climate policy, then I realized that they'll start listening, and they wouldn't argue back based on this or that, you know. And it was very detached away from your own morals, I guess. It was very different from your individual action, so they didn't feel as threatened with it, you know, like, hey, how come this guy is doing it? How come I'm not doing it? It was just talking about policies, talking about climate change, talking about the science behind it. And they became more open to talking about it, I guess. Yeah, so that was really strange to me. It was like, it was almost like groundbreaking. I was like, oh my God, I need to tell the world about this. Yeah,
for sure. So what are your thoughts on eco-friendly behaviors being labeled as gay? Have you experienced this before? If so, how do you usually like respond to these kind of comments?
I think there's so many things wrong with that statement, as in like when the accusation that, oh, being environmentally friendly is gay.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, there's nothing wrong with being gay.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I think that's like the root cause of the issue first.
Mm-hmm.
That why are you perceiving it as, like, the issue isn't even why are you perceiving it as gay, is what's wrong with being perceived as gay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's also like so toxic, you know.
Yeah.
And the second issue is that just because one person is more connected with their passions, their interests, their love for something doesn't mean that they are gay. You know, I find it very hard to see the correlation between liking the same gender and loving the environment.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is it just me? No, I think the idea that you are considered less feminine if you know, more feminine and less masculine if you love the earth, it stems from a very skewed perception of masculinity in general. You know, that your ideas define how much of a man you are.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel that it's a really warped idea, because my view of masculinity is that you can dress however you want, you can do whatever you can walk however you want, you can speak however you want, but as long as you have that confidence that you are a man and you are 100% comfortable in your skin as a man, then that dictates how masculine you are, you know. So the fact that they think that, oh, my actions of recycling, my actions of using a reusable tote bag, my actions of eating more meat makes me more of a man is a very skewed perception.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you can do anything and then still be comfortable as a man and immerse yourself in that masculinity and love that masculinity. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I also read this thing about how usually men who feel secure in their manhood are more comfortable mm-hmm. going green. So I guess like the refusal to act more eco-friendly is, it like stems from an insecurity of not feeling like validated enough as a man.
Yeah, totally. So I totally really understand. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a really fragile armor of ego or masculinity that people hide under, it's very toxic, you know, because I feel like toxic masculinity is the idea that there's just this one ideal man, like this mm-hmm. one image, perfect image of a man, you know. And if you're not the image, then you fall flat. You fail at it. You know, you're not a good enough man.
Yeah.
And I guess having that image of someone who cares for the planet doesn't fall under that image. Mm-hmm. So it's really, I can sort of understand it for certain guys who feel that they're threat, but it's really a very like hollow shell, you know, that you just need to break through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how do you think this image can be reimagined? Because I know like marketing and branding and that plays a role, but from the individual, how do you think one can, I guess you're doing a good job of that, but like how can other people also you. Like contribute to this?
Hmm.
Because I also guess it requires guys to step up. Currently a lot of it, you know, females calling out this issue.
Yeah, but at the same time, if a guy does it, they just kind of like shrug him off as like, oh, he's gay, or he's he doesn't know what he's talking about, or you know, he just doesn't want to put in the effort to, like, you know, gain muscle or some shit. You know what I mean? But yeah, I think it's, we need more men in who are more open to different ideas of masculinity and different ideas of what a man can be. You know, I think because so many different guys are suffering under that shell of toxic masculinity, and that they don't feel comfortable in their skin because they don't fit the ideal image of a man. You know, mm-hmm. and even though they would love to be out of that shell, it's so difficult breaking out of that shell, admitting to yourself that, hey, this is not what a man is supposed to look like, and I can be a man even if I don't look like that. Mm-hmm. And like the idea is incredibly freeing, but it's very scary to every man as well. And I think I can speak on personal experience. Like admitting to myself that, hey, I don't fit the image and that's okay was very difficult. You know, I mean, being a man itself is a real privilege, and I cannot say that, oh, it's been very difficult, but it is still a struggle to admit that to yourself. And I think one thing people can do to admit that to themselves is really just kind of examine the different men in their lives and see whether are they actually happy and with who they are, you know, and just analyze what kind of man they want to become, you know. So, yeah, I think it's a big issue in our society and we should really just address that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you have been able to influence the men in your life to adopt more eco-friendly behaviors or deviate from the stereotypical image of a man?
Well, to the extent of my impact, I'm not entirely sure. I think I have done a good job in normalizing the idea mm-hmm. of a guy that is passionate about something and who really loves the environment. You know, mm-hmm. I think I've normalized the idea. Whether or not I have influence a lot of people and a lot of guys into, you know, like, you know, going vegan or you know, like getting interested in climate politics, I'm not too sure. Mm-hmm. But I think on a personal, on a friend-to-friend level, I think it's just always about just influencing your sphere first, you know, and before you go on social media and like tell everybody go vegetarian and try your best there. I think it's just within your own social space, just try to normalize the idea first, you know. So I think I've done a good job in that. Hopefully, mm-hmm. if my friends are listening to this, please tell me if I have not done a good job.
Yeah, for sure. So do you ever experience eco-anxiety? If so, how do you usually cope with this?
Yes, I do. And I'm horrible at coping at it. I'm 100% okay with admitting that I'm horrible at coping with climate anxiety because it is a very scary thing. And I think it really affects my mental health a lot of time. I can go like go nights without sleeping, just thinking about Singapore's horrible climate policy, you know, it just angers me so much.
Yeah.
And I guess the most effective way is just to shut everything off. And I know some people find that terribly toxic or terribly unhealthy, but to me, that's just the most effective way. Just shutting everything down for like maybe a few days or just a few hours, you know. Because if you just remove everything from your head, you're not ignoring the problems. You're just letting your mind rest for a while, you know. And then I think another way to cope with this is keeping yourself grounded, you know. And I don't mean to sound like corny and stuff, but I think spirituality also helps a lot in this. And then this would bring me on to talking about interface together with environmental stuff. So just keeping ourselves grounded in spirituality also, I think, I know a lot of friends who use Buddhism, like meditation, as a form of coping with the eco-anxiety. So I think it's just really keeping yourself grounded and just pursuing what you want to pursue instead of, you know, just keep your mind detached away from these things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're not ignoring it, you're just giving yourself a break, a breather. For me, I love hiking, and then I love the outdoors, so I would really just like immerse myself in it. So I don't take my mind off the environment. I kind of give myself a break and ground myself as to why I'm doing this in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
How about you? I'm quite curious, like, how do other environmentalists or activists do it?
I haven't really thought about this. But yeah, no, I think a lot of it for me is also just like reconnecting with nature. I think reminding myself mm-hmm. of like why I want to fight for this in the first place. Because I think some people are more motivated by preventing destruction, but some people are mm-hmm. more towards like preserving nature.
Oh my God, I love that point. Yeah, yeah. I totally understand what you mean. Yeah.
But yeah.
I think so much about like, I think the burnout comes when you just want to destroy a system. When you're dealing with such an abstract concept like destroying a system, and your passion for something is based on the consequence, when I think it should really ground yourself in why you're doing this in the first place, mm-hmm. which is your passion, your love for the environment, right?
Yeah.
So I think if activism is based off destroying something, that's terribly unsustainable. It's really unhealthy in the long mm-hmm. run. So
yeah.
I totally get what you mean.
Yeah. So for me, I feel like I've always been motivated by like the beauty of nature and being able to preserve it and being able to like being reminded of why this is an important thing to fight for in the first place is a good way of like keeping myself grounded.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, it's always just like refreshing to be in nature as well. It calms your mind. And
totally agree.
Yeah. So I think that's one method for me.
Cool.
Yeah. So you were talking about how you were reading about interfaith environmentalism. Could you talk a bit more about this and why it's important?
Sure. So like I kind of realized in Singapore, I only can speak on behalf of Singapore. So it's like the styles of climate dissent, we were talking about it, and it was mostly a religious Western or American style of dissent, you know. So people were just protesting, or you know, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. We have gained miles talking, protesting, and using these styles of dissent. But I realized there's this whole missing portion that we could really tap on, which was interfaith environmentalism,
mm-hmm.
because I kind of realized that almost all, if I'm not wrong, almost all religions talk about divine creation and the reason why we should preserve our planet, right? So why aren't we tapping onto these huge organizations like the church, the temples, and in Singapore we have our four principal religions, right? Which is Hinduism, Taoism, Buddhism, Islam, and Christianity. So, and these are such huge organizations that we're not tapping onto, because I mean, as a Catholic, there are so many religious doctrines and religious teachings that advocate for environmental conservation. So why aren't we tapping onto these as voices towards the government to tell them, okay, you know, now all the four religions are fighting for climate change. What is the government going to do about it? You know, so mm-hmm. and these are such big institutions that provide such a large voice for us, you know, and the government has a tendency to kind of like reduce like protesters to greenies, like, oh, they're just radicals, they're just environmental buffs, you know, they don't represent the entire population. But these four principles, they do represent the entire Singaporean population. Not the entire, but a large proportion of it. And if we could mobilize these voices, it'll be so much louder than just protesting at Hong Lim Park, for example. You know, so if we could really just tap onto these resources, it'll be just amazing, you know. And I mean, I talked about it just now, and the benefits of spirituality and ground and getting you grounded onto your main purpose. I think, and it's also really good in spreading the message across the population as well. You know, if more religious leaders could talk about being environmentally friendly or doing these little things to change your habits, you know, I think the entire population will be so actively environmentally friendly because of that. Hopefully, you know, you can spread the extent of spreading the message should be way bigger as well. So yeah, I think it's such an important resource that we could really tap onto.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the argument for environmentalism can be catered to like a Catholic demographic?
I mean, okay, so we in the Catholic domain, we do have a saint whom I really love. His name is Saint Francis of Assisi. And he's kind of like the patron saint of the environment. So I think using saints and Pope Francis released his own, shucks, I forgot what the doctrine is called, but it's called Laudato Si, and it's an encyclical, that's what it's called, sorry. An encyclical on the environment. And if you really analyze the language in his encyclical, it really makes the environment, it turns those statistics, it turns climate change, that's a big concept, into a more spiritual, individual concept for people to consume, you know. And if people are saving the environment because of God, because this is their purpose, it'll be so much more, it's so much less daunting than doing it, because the rainforest is burning. You're doing it because, you know, global leaders are neglecting it. You know, it becomes a more personal issue, and it becomes a lot more convincing that, okay, I'm still doing this because I love God, because of my personal relationship with God. So it makes it a lot more personal thing. And at least for me, it's really grounding, and it's based on love. I think that's exactly my point, that, and what we were talking about before, that religion kind of brings it and it kind of grounds it based on love rather than destroying a system or dismantling capitalism in general. You know, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like with anyone, the most effective way to cater the whole environmental argument to them is just by tailoring it to like their interests and what they're most passionate about.
Exactly.
Something that like reaches deep within their soul.
Yeah, and what reaches more deep than religion, right? So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, for sure. So you talked a lot about your discontent with Singapore's policy regarding climate change.
Yeah.
So if you were to change something about Singapore right now, what would it be with regards to the climate?
I think it's generally known that Singapore's within the environmental community, it's generally known that Singapore's climate policy is just horrible and it's trash and it's very depressing. But I think one thing that if Singapore were to change is to be more transparent with how bad their climate policies are. I mean, I'm not asking them to admit, okay, we have shitty climate policies. I'm asking them to be less blatant about how well they think they're doing. You know, because I think Singapore, we have kind of like developed this image of like, oh, garden city, sustainable, you know. But those are just very surface value images of Singapore, you know, like what, green buildings? And I just saw your post in Hong Kong, you know, and the greenwashing there. And I think it's exactly the same in Singapore.
Yeah, I think I read about that as well.
It's incredibly upsetting just watching them wallow in their self-gratification. You're like, hey, you know, we did it, you know, but you didn't do it. You're still like the fifth largest oil refinery. So I think it's to really walk the talk. Like, that's what pisses me off the most, that they don't walk the talk. And they kind of like relish in their image as, the developed city and a sustainable city, which is not, you know, and it's incredibly problematic. So if they could really match their actions with their words, I think that would be the most amazing thing ever. I want you to say... I'm not even asking you to change all your policy immediately. I'm just asking you to admit that whatever you're doing now is not sustainable in the long run. And whatever you say you're doing, you're actually not really doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I read something about how even Gardens by the Bay, a lot of the nature that's there is like imported or it's artificial. Yeah. And it's just like
In fact, the entire Marina Bay is just all reclaimed land that we got from... sometimes illegally, sometimes from like Cambodia and just regional regional countries mm-hmm. is terribly unsustainable, and it's so ironic. That's the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's just difficult because to the common person, it's just like, it's so aesthetic. It's like a nice place to take photos.
And this whole rhetoric of like a garden city, oh, come on. It's so 1998. Like, why are you doing this?
Ultimate greenwashing.
Yeah, it's ultimate greenwashing. Exactly. Yeah.
So, what do you think is an overlooked issue when it comes to climate change or climate action?
I think at its core, for me, the most overlooked issue is its impact on people. Like, climate change impact on people. I think people kind of disconnect. People kind of disconnect climate change from people in general. They think, oh, let's help the animals, let's help this. But we also need to know that a huge proportion of things being affected by climate change is people, you know. And it's not just random people. It's poor communities. It's coastal indigenous communities. It's those people who are suffering the most under climate change, you know. So, and I can give you an example. When I was in junior college, I did an eco-fest, right? And then I was the one talking about saving animals and etc. And my teacher just kind of outed me in the lecture hall. He said, why instead of focusing on the animals, let's try focusing on the people first. And then it kind of disturbed me, because how can one think that climate change is detached from people? You know, there's so many people suffering from droughts, from floods. And these are poor communities who are being the most affected by it. So I think at its core, we need to center ourselves on, we're not just fighting for the animals, we're not fighting for an abstract concept, we're fighting for actual people out there, you know, who are suffering for this. So I think that's the most, I mean, it's been talked about, but I think it's also a huge overlooked issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think recently with the whole Black Lives Matter movement picking up on social media, there's been a lot more awareness of how these different like justice issues interconnect.
So it's like intersectionality in the community, right? Yeah, I think it's amazing.
Yeah, but definitely still see in a lot of vegan groups and like vegan accounts, I definitely still see a lot of disconnect between these different issues.
Mm-hmm.
Had someone commenting on one of my photos like, veganism is a justice movement for the animals, like keep humans separate, this is not the focus of what we're writing for. I guess for them, it's like the ultimate fight is for the animals.
Okay.
And so it's hard for them to like move away from that and focus on other things. But I don't know. It's like, if you care for the animals, you have to care for everything else, because it's all interconnected.
Yeah, I really think that if you're an activist, if you're an environmental activist, you're kind of automatically an activist for everything else, you know?
I think
The toleration of injustice anywhere is the toleration of injustice everywhere, you know? I mean, I don't mean to sound like the Truman Doctrine, but it's just that concept of injustice and how can you tolerate one side and accept the other side of injustice, you know? It just doesn't sit well, with me at least, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Because ultimately, climate change is a human rights issue as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you're just fighting for a livable future.
Mm. And for everybody, you know, so yeah.
So I guess sort of building on that, what are some of the biggest misconceptions when it comes to climate activism? What are some of the biggest mistakes people make when it comes to their like individual roles in fighting for climate action?
I'm going to split up to like 3 points. The first one will be that you need to know everything. I think this is the most exhausting one of all the 3 points. I think I don't know whether I can call myself an activist or not, but if I were to call myself an activist, there's a lot of pressure to know everything, to be always on top of the news, talking about these things, to really break down, you know, all the headlines and to tell people everything, you know. And I honestly can't keep up. I really don't know how some people have the energy to do it, and some of these environmental accounts, and I really, really respect them for it. But I think I've accepted the fact that I cannot know everything, and I should be aware of these things, and I should know, but I shouldn't fully immerse myself and take 100% of my time and energy to really know everything. Just you need to know that you can't know everything, and you don't need to. You know, so I think you need to take comfort in the fact that that it's all right not knowing everything, and just being very open to different ideas and learning from other people instead of the one teaching. You know, I think someone told me that before, and I thought, okay, it's such comforting advice to know that I don't need to be the one who is always fighting to tell the news or to educate people. I can be the one learning as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's always it's a more sustainable thing to really learn and to grow as well, not to always be the one telling people to do things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Number two would be that climate activism is only about climate change.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what we were talking about before, that it's so intersectional. You cannot just be an activist for climate change, you know. The minute you're an activist for climate change, you're being actively anti-racist, you're constantly being anti-homophobic,
mm-hmm.
anti-sexist, and, you know, you just have to be actively anti-injustice in general.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the last point would be your impact defines your passion. I wouldn't say that I made a very big impact. Like, I only have, like, what, 600 followers on Instagram, I think. I can't remember. But so my impact isn't a lot, you know. I wouldn't say it defines your passion, you know. Like, how can you judge someone's interests or passions from their influence and their impact, their consequence, their impact in general?
Mm-hmm.
So going by that belief, I think you just need to keep yourself grounded and to know that whatever you're doing your best, and that whatever, in how small or how big your arena is, you are still making a difference in whatever way possible.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think those are my 3 points on the biggest misconception of climate activism.
No, those are all really good points. And I think especially the third one, social media is one thing, but also how you exhibit like these different behaviors and walk the talk in real life is so important.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do think everyone has so much influence. Like, even if it's just one person, they can go and influence mm-hmm. other people. And so everyone's an influencer. So, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think everyone has to be an activist in that sense. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Could you talk a bit about what it's like thrifting as a man? Because you started your own thrifting initiative. So if you could talk a bit more about that.
It's incredibly depressing. Because, you know, when you walk into a thrift store, you have like these rows of women's clothes, and you have like, wow, is this so many different colors, so many different textures, and then you ask them where the guy section is, and they give you just one dilapidated rack, and then you're just like, what is wrong with this? And then you look through the shirts and like sweat stains on it. I'm like, oh my god, what is this? So yeah, it is quite difficult thrifting as a man.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's also taught me to like explore my different fashion styles and mm-hmm. explore even the female section as well. So it's very fun, I guess. It's a more of an adventure, I guess, if you're really up for the adventure to dig through like packs and packs of clothes just to find that one piece that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think honestly it has a lot to do with masculinity as well, why men don't thrift.
Uh-huh.
I think it's a lot to do with that idea that there's only one type of man and there's only one way you can dress as well. Anything, any color too vibrant, any texture too flamboyant, mm-hmm. you are considered less of a man, you know. And then I think that's why guys don't want to explore different styles of fashion and therefore thrifting and by extension thrifting, you know. So I think that's one of the issues why guys don't thrift enough. And even if you're thrifting, it'll be super expensive branded vintage things, you know, which I have no interest in. So I don't know, I think that there's still the very exclusive idea to guys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think another issue is that not enough guys know about thrifting in general and where to donate their clothes. So we need to bust that myth as well. And I take it upon myself to really tell all my friends, like, hey guys, you can find so many nice pieces of clothing when you thrift. And I think I want to be an example or someone who can find, who has a good fashion sense, hopefully.
Uh-huh.
And who can say like, oh, I never ever shop fast fashion. I just thrift, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll be like, oh shit, okay, maybe I should try to do it. So yeah.
Yeah. But do you think it's also, it could be like a good thing as well? Because I think based on my experience or like what I've seen, guys tend to wear their clothes for longer, or like they're less focused on chasing like the latest trend, having to constantly like restock their wardrobe. So do you think that could be a reason why they're donating less and why there are less options for males to thrift?
I think in this day and age, I think I don't know. I don't see it as common as previously, as I did previously, you know, how like, only this guys only wear a white shirt and jeans kind of thing. I don't believe in that anymore. I think you look on social media, everybody is on to like the latest trends and everything, you know, everybody's just constantly buying clothes. So I don't think we can say that guys don't consume as much clothes as women do anymore. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm pretty sure there's a statistic to that, but I don't have it on top of my head. But I think even though guys, maybe they don't take up as much as like the bigger population of consumers, we still need to find every way possible to live sustainably, you know. Even if you're shopping for like a plain t-shirt or whatever, there are secondhand options for you, you know, on Carousell. Carousel is our local vintage.
Oh yeah,
vintage,
we have
our
it
local
as well.
Online store. Oh, you guys have it? Okay, yeah. Great. So, yeah, so exactly that. I agree to you to a certain extent that guys don't really take up a very large proportion of people who consume like fast fashion, but there's still room, you know, that I still know a lot of guys who really participate in fast fashion. So mm-hmm. I think and people are just not willing to explore thrifting, and guys specifically just need to open the idea to themselves.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a bit more about the platform you started for, is it Clothing Exchange?
I think we did have Clothing Exchange, but it was more like a thrift store.
Okay, yeah.
So I teamed up with Conscious Living Collective, which is a group from Yale and US, one of our universities in Singapore. Mm-hmm. And they talk about sustainable fashion. And so we teamed up and realized that, okay, we realized that we acknowledged the terrible lack of men's clothes in normal thrift stores. So we're like, okay, let's start our own menswear only pop-up thrift store. Mm-hmm. So we got donations from everybody. We teamed up with other thrift stores to collect their menswear. And we decided, okay, you know what? Let's make it accessible, cheap, and available to guys, you know, to try to introduce them to the idea of thrift shopping. So we set up like a pop-up booth, and it was pretty amazing because the turnout was crazy. Like there's a queue sneaking out of the shop, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think all our pieces, we sold it for like $3 to $5. So it was honestly really, really good. And the pieces we got were branded, were even not branded, but they're just beautiful, all the pieces. So that was really good. I really enjoyed doing that. Hopefully we can do something like that in the future.
That's super cool. Yeah. So I guess a very broad question, what would your vision for the future be? So I guess your vision of a more climate friendly world, how would that be? And also, where would you see yourself in like 5 years and the kind of work you'll be doing with regards to climate change?
I think my main vision would be a transparent Singapore, mm-hmm. in terms of climate change, and open with their policies, and more how should I say this, like open to the ideas of the people. Mm-hmm. I think freedom of speech and et cetera in Singapore is like a super big issue, and I don't want to tap into that yet. Uh-huh. But I think small steps would be just being transparent and having our leaders acknowledge that they are not doing good enough. Mm-hmm. You know, and they need to take further steps. You know, I don't need to see like, oh, we're gonna abolish oil and gas immediately. I don't think that's possible, but I think we just need to see more transparency in whatever they're doing. I think that's my vision for Singapore. But for myself, honestly, I have no idea. It's a really difficult question. I'll be going to uni next year. So hopefully I can get in, like, you know, grow more within that 4 years of university. And hopefully I can really find out more what I want to do in the future. I mean, I currently want to pursue academia, but I'm not entirely sure of that either. It's a whole mess. I'm a mess.
Will you be staying in Singapore?
For my bachelor's, yes, I want to stay in Singapore. For maybe for like master's or further studies, I'll probably go overseas just to really explore. You know, because I would want to do something in ecology or conservation biology or just conservation work in general. So Singapore is not like the biggest place to understand that. So, you know, hopefully I can explore other regions in Southeast Asia, like maybe Indonesia or Malaysia, where they have like a lot more biodiversity. So I can explore that in those regions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So is it true that you can't protest in Singapore?
I mean, to a certain extent, because I mean, we do have outlets like Hong Lim Park, which is the only place in Singapore we can actually protest, right? Which is where we had our climate rally last year. Was it last year? Damn it, I forgot. I think it was last year, yeah. Probably. We had our climate rally last year there. Uh-huh. And where we have Pink Dot, like Singapore's main LGBTQ event at Hong Lim Park as well. So it's true because we need to get a license. We need to get a license to protest there. Mm-hmm. And everybody who protests there needs to be a Singaporean or PR. Oh. And they can't be foreigners. So foreigners are not allowed to protest within the park itself also. Uh-huh. So to get a license to protest, it really kind of dictates that your cause needs to be approved by the government.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know if freedom of speech is constrained, is it really freedom of speech, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like a big debate and interesting, but it's also quite depressing. Like, you know, I'm not too sure whether you're aware there was an occasion where one of our climate activists in Singapore took a piece of cardboard and wrote something about the oil and gas industry.
Uh-huh.
And because of that, they arrested him and I can't remember what they did to him, but he just posted a picture holding a cardboard sign and they had, you know, action against him. And everyone was so shocked, like, this guy didn't do anything. He's not like an eco-terrorist. He's not going to threaten to bomb a pipeline or something, uh-huh. You know, so it was a really big issue and it was quite scary looking at that. The fact that all of us are capable of doing such thing. And I feel like all of us, all climate activists, can just write on a signboard and walk out and can get arrested for it. You know, it's a very scary thing.
That's scary, yeah. Yeah, I guess, I mean, it makes sense that now during coronavirus, a lot of activism has to shift online anyway. So maybe maybe this is like the beginning of like a new era of how activism is carried out.
Yeah.
And maybe it'll be better for places where freedom of speech is like restricted.
Yeah, that's true. That's a really interesting idea. I didn't think about that. Yeah. Like how activism is shifting together with like coronavirus and this new world order, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So if someone wants to get more involved with learning about environmental issues or climate activism, where would you direct them to? What are some resources that you suggest, including like Instagram accounts, YouTube channels, like articles, anything?
Okay, personally, I get all my news, like my environmental news from The Guardian, because I think The Guardian is just, I don't really know what the criteria of accurate is, but uh-huh. I think The Guardian gives very good news on, gives very regular updates on the environmental, like the whole entire section just based on the environment. So, and I love the articles there. On Instagram, I think Lepak in SG is like a environmental calendar, if I'm not wrong. But anyway, I think they give very good updates because they summarize all the green events in Singapore and all on one page. And you can just really scroll through what I can participate this week, whether next month or, you know, and what I've missed or, you know, this stuff. So I think Lepang actually is a really good resource. And I can't really think of any Instagram accounts on top of my head right now. but there's so many just stuff on Instagram, just like local activists who are just amazing and super inspiring. And I don't know how they have so much energy for all of this, but they're just super inspiring. Yeah. And I think you can get all the resources from there.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Everyday Activist podcast. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to rate and review the show, because that makes a huge difference in helping me get the word of the podcast out. Also, don't forget to subscribe and stay tuned for upcoming episodes. Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you next Monday.